To read Back to Reality, the best-selling novel of the Bestseller Experiment by the two Marks, go to bestsellerexperiment.com/back to reality.
And subscribe to this podcast to get loads of extra bonuses. Go to bestsellerexperiment.com/subscribe. Let's run the show. Hello and welcome to the Bestseller Experiment, where we continue to discover what makes a best-selling novel and inspire you to finish your book. I'm Mark DeVoe.
And I am Mark Stay. And before we leap with gay abandon into this week's episode, I'd like to give a big shout out to our sponsors at Scrivener. Scrivener is the official writing app of the Bestseller Experiment. It's the app that Mr. DeVoe and I use to write our best-selling Kindle book, Back to Reality. And it can be yours, yours to keep forever. Just pop over to Literature and Latte. And when you put in the, when you're buying it, just put in the code BestsellerXP and you will get 20% off, which is a fairly chunky discount. Literatureandlatte.com, but code is BestsellerXP.
And guess what, Mark? I've actually convinced my editor to switch to Scrivener. Isn't that awesome?
Really?
Stealth mode. I said, if we're going to do this together, you've got to come on board with Scrivener. And she has.
That's fascinating because we did this brilliant edit masterclass with Emed Akhtar and Caroline Hulse a couple of weeks ago as our live show. And Emed made an interesting point. He was saying that Scrivener is a writer's tool, whereas Word is an editor's tool, which I thought was an interesting distinction to make. But yeah, this could be revolutionary, Mark. You could change the whole industry.
It starts with one editor, right? And then it just ripples everyone. So Catherine, if you're out there listening, which I know you do. Actually, we met through the podcast. Isn't that amazing? I met my editor through the podcast. So Catherine, who is actually finishing editing, my first nonfiction book, which is going to be around the motivational minutes that I do in the podcast, which I haven't done in a while because I've been busy writing the book and adding lots of new ones. So I'll be telling you more about that. But Mr. Stay, I've been away for a week. I finished my secret mission. I delivered my milk tray for all of you UK 70s fans out there. But what's... do you remember those adverts? Weren't they brilliant?
I do. Yeah.
Oh, they actually do have milk tray in England, in Canada, because the other day my daughter and I were in a big grocery store looking at advent calendars as we're coming into Christmas, trying to get planned for Christmas. They are so expensive. I mean, yeah. I moan about hobnobs. Advent calendars for the amount of chocolate you get per square, whatever, grammage, it's ridiculous. So what we did, get this. We've bought a box of milk tray and we're going to DIY our own advent calendar.
Nice. Class.
84 pieces over 30 days. Like, oh, maybe 24. Or maybe and some advent calendars have a lot more. Now they go up to New Year's. Mm. You know, do you have that in England?
No.
Yeah.
No.
It's obviously a North American thing.
That's weird.
Because the kids here will not buy one if it only goes to Christmas Day.
I mean, advent is advent. That's why it's called advent. It's from the first.
I know. Somebody did it once, you see, and now everyone's doing it up to New Year's. Soon there'll be a 365-day advent calendar, which if anyone makes one, Mark and I will happily product market for you and test.
Oh, don't. I mean, it's not like I don't shove enough chocolate in my mouth already.
So anyway, back to books, Mark. Sorry, I'm going off on a chocolate tangent again. How have your last couple of weeks been?
I've had a week off. I had a week off. I End of Magic is done, and then
Hang on. just breeze past that. End of Magic's done.
We've talked about that before.
It's a big milestone. Yeah. We have been talking it for weeks. That's why you have to stop and acknowledge the fact you've actually done it. Finished.
And then I did a rewrite on my middle grade book, Interstellar Mega Blaster. Thanks to some notes from none other than Julian Barr, who was a beta reader for me, which really, really helped. So I've did that and put that away as well. And I've just had a week off. I've been reading a brilliant book by Tade Thompson called Rosewater, fantastic science fiction book. And I'm desperate to get Tade on the show. I'm hoping to speak to him very, very soon. I've been putting my feet up, basically. So
can I just say how awesome is this job, eh? You read a book and you're like, I really like the book. I'm gonna reach out and chat with the author. That is bloody marvellous, isn't it, really?
No, it's good. It's good.
I've been
flirting with him on Twitter. It's great. I'm reeling him in. But I'm getting
plenty
the urge
of authors.
Again. Having had a week off, I'm getting the urge again. I'm getting an itch, so I need to start typing.
Yeah, I can see you getting antsy there.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, that's good, though, because that shows that it's so ingrained in your DNA to write now.
Yeah, well, it is now.
Whereas,
absolutely.
You know, a lot of us get the itch when, when, you know, we haven't written for 3 months. Oh my goodness!
And yeah, how about yourself? With I've been getting little emails telling me the very last Monster book is coming my way. So is that what's happening now?
Yes, it's so exciting. We actually took delivery yesterday of 2,500 copies. And I tell you what, hardback books don't halfway a ton.
Yeah.
£20 a box, and there's only 20 in each box. But we took, so we didn't really think it through, I'll be honest. And actually, I'm going to blame you now, because we were talking at, no, I won't blame you, but this is, I just, honestly, the things you don't realize. So what we've basically done is we've published from start to finish, not using a distributor or anything. We're doing everything ourselves, website ordering, dispatching it, and even hand numbering every single book.
Whoa.
Which at the time sounded brilliant. But yesterday I looked at 2,500 books. And what we didn't work out is those books have to go up 3 flights of stairs, each book opened, each book written in. Of course, the ink doesn't dry very quickly because of the nice glossy paper we're using. So we're having all these books left out. Pack the boxes back up, bring them back downstairs. Honestly, I mean, it's going to be worth it. But the next week, I'm going to be like chiropractor central because it's just outrageous. Why we didn't spend the extra money getting them printed, like, because you have to, obviously it's something unique in every book if you have to print a different number in every book. So it's quite expensive to print unique numbers. But there's also something about having a limited numbered edition. And so that's what we're doing. And this weekend, actually, we're having a 2-day exhibition. We've got all the press coming again. We've got over 1,000 people.
Wow.
Already coming to the expo. It's outrageous. In a tiny little town of 15,000 people on Vancouver Island, we've got 1,000 people.
Bloody hell.
Coming that we know of. And it's just gone front page on the newspaper here, so we think there's going to be a ton of others. This is the most incredible thing. This week, I've got to announce this. This week, if pre-orders were counted in the Canadian charts, my wife's book, the very last Monster book, would be the number one best-selling children's hardback in Canada. But they don't count pre-orders.
Can I just say, at the busiest time of the year as well?
I know.
You know?
Isn't that nuts?
If this was February, that'd great. But this is the busiest time of year for book sales.
And if that wasn't enough yesterday, Mark, I got an email out of the blue from an author called Robert Munch. Now, he's a Canadian author, but he's pretty big, I believe, worldwide. He has sold 35 million copies of one of his many kids' books called Love You Forever. And the joke is that if you have a baby shower, you get like 17 copies of it.
Yeah.
That's probably why it sells so much. But it's one of those classic books that's been going for years and everyone loves it. But he reached out and said he was really touched by the story of Jenny and the book that she wrote. So there's some magic happening around this. We're just very excited to get it out there. So if you haven't ordered it yet, and I know a lot of people have, so thank you so much, bestseller experiment listeners. I recognize names popping up. If you'd like to order it, you can still get it at lastmonsters.com. But actually, we're running out of limited editions, and we don't know if we'll be doing another hardback. So,
The Robert Munch thing. Do you think he'll give you a quote? I mean, obviously, you can't put it on the book, but you can.
No, that's what I'm going to email him back about and ask. He's had some health issues, bless him.
Which he
mentioned in his email. But I think, I mean, that's partly what we've been doing on the podcast, is learning about how important quotes are. So I think it's only right to go and talk to some big... So if you're a big children's author and you'd like to have a look at a electronic version of the book, drop me an email. And if you'd like to give us a quote, that would be amazing. Because there's a lot of magic around this book. So I'll just put it out there to any children's authors out there, or even bigger authors, big people authors, I should say, not bigger authors, big people authors.
Big people author.
Well, I've been talking about we say to the exhibition that it's for kids and big kids, right? Because it's a whole, you know, you have to seek the monsters in the pictures. It's very scary and exciting. So the kids bring the adults along, so the adults have got someone to hold their hand with.
Wonderful. Look, I just if you're listening and you're thinking, how do I get quotes for my book? I just blogged about this. If you go to markstaywrites.com, I've got a blog there called Getting Pre-Pub Quotes for Your Novel, and I take you through how I did this. And quotes have started coming in for The End of Magic, which is really exciting. And it's one of these things, because people will say, oh, they have no effect on me. It has no effect on me whatsoever. But I think it's all part of a combination of things. You know, someone says, I've heard about this book, I've read this book, it's really good. You go to the bookshop, you see it on the table. Maybe you heard something about it on the radio, on a podcast. And then when you pick it up, it's got a wonderful cover. And then you turn it over, the blurb is great. And then you see someone has said, oh, this book is the best thing since sliced bread, Stephen King or whatever. It's not one thing that makes you buy, it's that combination of things. I think once you get that balance right, once you put all of those things into the mix, then you've got a much greater chance of people buying your book.
No, you're absolutely right. And I do think that if you weight different things, I think the quote actually has, especially if you've got a really juicy quote from somebody famous, that has a huge weighting, and it can be the decision maker. It can be the thing that tip people over the edge when they're sitting looking at the book thinking, man, what do you think? And then suddenly they read that quote and they think, well, if he likes it, there's something about that personal recommendation. Talking of End of Magic, Mark and I can see each other as we record these. We see each other on Skype. I'm just going to show you something, Mr. Stay, on my camera. See if this works. Do you see that there?
Oh, my God. You're actually going to bloody pre-order a copy.
I've actually bought Mark's book live on the Bestseller Experiment. I'm now official, because I've been promising for months that I would do this. Hey, look at that.
Hey.
I've got all these little confetti things. You see, because basically happened was, the story is Mark was obviously doing a really interesting crowdfunding exercise with this book, End of Magic. And I said to him, whilst it was all happening, obviously I was away from the podcast, I was trying to watch it because I wanted to be the person that bought the book that took it right over the 100% mark. And I missed it because I was...
There it is.
So I'm looking forward to getting my copy. Have you got it through your end now? Can you see it?
Yeah, wonderful. Thank you so much.
There we go. You see, I'm cleverer than the average Joe out there. I waited until you actually finished it to pay for it, right? I want to know it's coming, mate.
Go on.
I was going to say, isn't it brilliant though, having people paying up front for a book before it's finished, because you don't have an option to not finish it. So I strongly recommend to people, like, do a crowdfunding campaign, even if you've only started your book, because once you've got even one person who's paid a fiver or a tenner to get your book, you're going to finish that book.
It focuses the mind. It really does. It makes you think, you know, there's going to be someone at the end of this reading it. And it's not just friends and family. It's people you've never heard of, complete strangers, you know. So it's...
Although if Aunt Gertrude had ordered it, you're in big trouble, because she'll be on at you every week.
Well, you know, like, wagging the finger. You know what? My first pledger was my Aunt Marion. Right, she was the first one who we've spoken about, Aunt Marion, previously. She's got romance novels available on Amazon. Marion Dante, look her up. She used to be a nun, and she's not a nun anymore. And she's written nonfiction and fiction about it. If you like that kind of clean romance, go for that kind of thing. Check it out. There you go, Auntie Marion. Thank you.
Go on. That's brilliant.
Yeah, she was the first. She got the ball rolling. So I shall always be very grateful to her.
I see. You see what you did, Aunt Marion? You created a monster. So, Mark, I think we'll dive into a bit of social media after our exciting interview today. But what we should say is, as we come up to the end of NaNoWriMo, as in the time of recording, there's been a lot of activity going on, folks. So if you've been chatting with Mr. Stay on Twitter or with us on Facebook, then listen out, because you might hear your name later on. Mm. But before we dive into the interview today, which is with none other than Mr. Stay,
the wonderful Mark Billingham. I was delighted to get Mark on the show. Mark is, he started out as a TV writer and stand-up comedian, and he writes the Tom Thorne thrillers. And he's one of the, Little Brown just announced, just before we did the interview, that he's just sold 5 million copies of his books worldwide. And he's just a mine of wonderful stuff.
Where does that put Mark in our list of best-selling authors on that we've interviewed? Is that top 10? Well, or is that not even top 10?
It might be top 10, but I mean, he's, he's a much loved figure in the crime community. He is like a hub. He's one of these guys who, I mean, he's funny. He's really warm. He's always great with advice. If you're a new crime writer, before we start recording, we were talking about Steve Kavanagh, who was on a few episodes ago. And, you know, Mark and Steve now get on. They're now good friends. You know, it is a community. And I say this again and again, if you're writing for a genre, you need to be part of that community. And I know someone like Mark or Ian Rankin or whatever might feel intimidating, but actually they want to help you up. They want to give you a leg up, you know, and Mark is great for that. And you'll hear all about this kind of stuff in the interview.
I guess if you find lots of mates in crime writing circles, you're kind of partners in crime in some way, aren't you?
Hey.
Oh, that was bad. That was bad. Let's just warm them up, shall we, Mark? That's why I don't do the interviews, because I'll get slapped by a wet fish. But so before we dive into that, we just wanted to talk very quickly about covers, because we have a very, very wonderful sponsor called De Monza, who we've been talking about, that produce very, very high-end covers. But Mark and I were discussing about the importance of not just having a cover created, but going through the process of creating a cover. And I know, Mark, you've been through this recently, haven't you, with End of Magic?
Yeah, well, I just got an email today saying my cover art should be ready next week, which is very exciting.
Very exciting.
Yeah, but if Unbound didn't offer that, I would definitely be going to someone like De Monza, because, you know, first of all, the covers are first class. They work internationally as well, which I think is really important. And there's this thing where you get to go back again and again and again and tweak them again and again, don't you? It's a really cool way that it works. It's a process.
Because when you think about designing a cover, you think about the final cover, but actually the process that we both know, having gone through it quite a few times now, and anyone else who's ever had a cover designed, it's you never get the perfect cover first time. It's actually almost like your starting point, and then you start tweaking things. And one thing that we did for Back to Reality, for our novel Back to Reality, was we used our BXP team, which is a private group that we've set up on Facebook for all our Patreon supporters. And we went to them with all the different covers that we had designed. And we actually ran a survey. We asked people to tell us we actually got them to rank, I think, their top three. And then we asked them what they liked about them. So we got some really amazing qualitative and quantitative data. That's going back to my marketing and stats days at uni. But absolutely fantastic, because the thing that we don't realize is the cover is not for us, really. The cover is actually for everyone who's going to buy it. Obviously, yeah, you want to get a cover that you love, but you've got to market test it. So we market tested it. And with De Monza, the thing I love about De Monza is they do unlimited revisions. Now, they say unlimited within reason. Obviously, you can't keep going back for forever and ever, but it means you're not under pressure with a lot of design companies where they say two revisions, which is ridiculous. I mean, could you imagine having like two shots at trying to get your cover right from getting the first artwork back? It's not going to happen. And that's why it's important investing in covers, and that's why it's important to pay a bit extra and go for a quality design cover. So what we've done with De Monza, we've asked them to support you guys by offering you a discount. So if anyone's looking to get a cover designed, now this discount is not going to be around forever. So pop along to demonza.com/bestsellerXP and scribble this down if you're thinking of doing it, so you've got it written down somewhere. demonza.com/bestsellerXP, and then you type in the code bestsellerXP and you get 10% off all of their packages. They do a lot of different things as well, not just cover design. So check them out. And by supporting them, you're also supporting this show as well, because they're sponsoring us currently.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, great stuff. Okay. Let's jump into that conversation with Mark Billingham, who started out in stand-up comedy. He talks about a surprising break that got him into TV writing. He talks about how a shout line got him a book deal. And we talk about all sorts of amazing stuff. And also, we talk about first drafts. You've heard last week's episode with Alison Belsham and her opinions on first drafts. You'll be interested to hear what Mark has to say about that. So let's jump in now. Mark Billingham, welcome to the Bestseller Experiment. How are you today, sir?
I'm all right, yeah. I'm ticking along. It's not too early, so I'm all right.
It's a bit early in the day to get fired up. But I first encountered you at my first BA conference, which was about 15 years ago, I think. And you were the MC for the evening, and you were really funny. And I was sitting next to John Wood, who works here at Orion. I said, he's really funny, that Mark Billingham. He should do stand-up comedy. And he says he does, your Wazzock. So you started out in comedy, didn't you?
Well, yeah. I mean, having given up on an acting career, well, having had an acting career, give up on me. Yeah, I started doing stand-up, which is the thing a lot of actors did sort of back then, because it was, so this is back in the mid-80s, and it wasn't quite the incredibly cutthroat competitive business it is now, stand-up comedy, when everybody wants to be a comic. You could kind of get into it then. So yeah, I started in about, I think I did my first gig in 87, and you know, you could do a gig and within 6 months you could be headlining the Comedy Store. You know, you could actually, it was a business you could break into, and yeah, did it for the best part of 25 years.
Excellent stuff. And let's touch upon the acting career, because you worked in shows like Dempsey and Makepeace, Juliet Bravo, The Bill, and my favourite, Maid Marian and Her Merry Men, which for listeners outside of the UK was basically the best historical comedy outside of Blackadder, I think.
Well, oddly, when they did show in America, when they showed it in America, they didn't realise it was a kids' show. They showed it back to back with Blackadder, you know, late at night in America. My favourite job by a long way, and the job without which I wouldn't be a writer. I mean, it's the job that turned me into a writer.
Well, quite. You did. You wrote an episode, didn't you? The one that's sort of based around the Crystal Maze, and we'll put a clip in the show notes, folks, you can have a look. How did that come about?
Well, Tony, myself and another guy called David Lloyd, we played Tony Robinson's henchman, Gary and Graham, and it was Tony's show, Tony's baby completely, but he was starting to get really, really busy. So by the time we got to the third series, he asked David and I to help him storyline it and start coming up with some ideas and whatever. Then we wrote an episode. And by the time the show finished, after four incredibly happy years, I'd just by default become a television writer, and I inherited a literary agent, and yeah, so started writing TV after that.
Fantastic. And that went on for a little while, but you did eventually move on to fiction. Why did you step away from screenwriting?
Because it's horrible. I'm not going to sugarcoat this. I got kind of fed up with it. I got absolutely fed up with it. I was writing a lot of kids stuff, a lot of kids animation shows, for, you know, some really good shows for Nickelodeon and all that kind of stuff. But the money for those shows comes from all over the place, and you'd have money coming in from three or four different European countries. So you'd just write a script happily, innocently, and then get script notes from four different countries, all of which conflicted with one another. And by the time you got onto draft 12 and they said, oh, could you put back that stuff you took out three drafts ago? You just started to lose the will to live. And there is so much work went into 1 half hour of television that I just thought, why am I not writing my own stuff?
I feel your pain. I think it's worked out all right, though, because last week, Little Brown announced that you've sold 5 million copies of your books worldwide. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I know. It is amazing because it really only seems like 5 minutes. I don't know how long I can, as a bloke the wrong side of 55, I don't know how I can still think of myself as a young Turk. But in my head, I am. In my head, I've only been doing this 5 minutes. You know?
Do you keep count the sales? Is that something you keep track of, or do you leave it to the publisher?
Not total sales. I wouldn't have a clue. Obviously, you know, when each book comes out, you're watching the bestseller list and you're seeing how the book does in comparison to the last one. I mean, one thing I am aware of, and this is something we may go on to talk about, is how many more books one sold, you know, even 10 years ago. Everybody, you know, I mean, I was clearing out a lot of clutter in my office the other day, and I was putting press clippings into a proper folder. And I've got all those press, you know, when you see your name in the bestseller list, you cut that out, unless, you know, well, I do. I don't know how sad that is, but I do. And I keep it to show my great grandchildren. And I could see how many more books I would have sold to get to number one 10 years ago than you would need to do now.
So you're talking about physical hardbacks.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, this is the time before ebooks kind of took off. But yeah, you had to sell a lot more books then.
Yeah. Now, we see that. Again, your contemporaries like Ian Rankin and Michael Connelly, you'll see their ebook pre-orders. I'm sure you're the same. Are huge. Hardback pre-orders, very, very, very healthy. But again, yeah, you compare them to 10 years ago. When did you start becoming aware of that split in the market?
I mean, I think kind of when all the noise started being made about ebooks, and there was a time when they just were I have to confess, I still don't own a Kindle, and I still, I'm very old school, which is partly because I love books and also because I'm just technically inept. I think I'm the only author that my desk editor told me this the other day. I'm the only author she deals with that has to have physical manuscripts. I can't use track changes. I just can't do any of that stuff. She has to send me the manuscript to do my copy edit.
Wow, that is old school. Are you not? I mean, you might not be as old school. We have Michelle Paver on here. She still uses WordStar and sends it in on a floppy disk. So
okay, I'm not quite. You know, I'm not using a quill and parchment. I do submit manuscripts on as files. Yeah.
But when it comes back to you, you get a big stack of paper and you go through it physically. And is that just how your brain works? You just prefer it that way?
I think I prefer it that way. I don't like change, and it's the way I started doing it. You know, no, I do like a great big, you know, stack of paper and a red pen, you know.
It sort of focuses the mind, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, it absolutely does. You can see, because I think it's so easy to miss stuff on track changes, and I'm sure that if I spent a couple of days trying to get to grips with it, I would, but I just can't be arsed.
Good for you. Okay. I'd like to play a game with you now that we call Backlist Bingo, which we did sort of nick from Danny Baker's show. I'd like you to pick a number between 1 and 10.
And so this is not in order of the books. This is completely random. Yeah. 7.
A 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Ah, Rush of Blood. This is a standalone, I believe, and you've got some TV in development. Is that right?
Yeah, it is a standalone novel. Gosh, how old is Rush of Blood? I don't know. 7? 2013, okay. Yeah, it was a standalone novel, partly set in America, partly set in the UK, about three couples who meet on holiday and make friends, and it turns out to be the biggest mistake of their lives. It's more than in development. It's one of the horror stories of television that I touched on earlier. You know, I've since had to get back into television because of the TV adaptations of the books. Rush of Blood was commissioned, greenlit, announced by the BBC, had a huge big press thing. You know, we've got this great new series coming. We're about to start filming. And then the writer pulled out. I'm not going to mention his name because he's somebody I'd quite like to slap. He pulled out because he thought he had bigger fish to fry. I think may have got an Oscar nomination or thought he had an Oscar nomination. I can't remember what it was. But anyway, when that writer went, the process went from greenlit to amberlit. And to this day, we now have another brilliant writer, a writer called John Donnelly, who's written wonderful scripts. So we're still hopeful that one day it will get made.
Excellent stuff. And this being a standalone, we'll get to your Tom Thorne books in a minute. Breaking away from Tom Thorne, is that something you do on a regular basis now? Is that something that, you know, refreshes, you know, exercises different parts that Tom Thorne maybe doesn't?
Yeah, it's absolutely that. I mean, I learned from great writers like Michael Connelly, who started a series, got a kind of fan base, I suppose, after 5 or 6 books, but then decided that the way to keep that series fresh was to step away and do something else. You know, you spend a year doing something else, spending time with another bunch of characters. That way, in theory at least, you come back to your series character fired up. You're fired up, so he's fired up. You can't wait to spend another year with him. I think it's the way to do it. So, yeah, I've written 3 or 4 standalones, and we'll carry on doing that, yeah.
Fantastic. Pick another number, please.
Oh, I thought that was it. I thought it was just 1.
No, you don't get off that easy.
All right, 2.
A 1 and a 2. Lazy Bones. Now, this was a prize winner. This won the Theakston's Old Peculiar Crime Novel of the Year in 2004. Was that your first prize?
It was. Yes, I think it was. I think it was. And it was, you know, it's a great prize to win. It still remains a great prize to win. It's a prize where readers have a say. You know, there's a judging panel, but readers have a vote. They vote books, I think, from the long list, the short list, and then have a vote in the final say. But it's also a vote it's also an award that is quite good commercially, to be honest about it. You know, your books get promoted in bookshops and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, it's a great award to win. It's presented every year at the Harrogate Crime Festival, which is the best crime festival in the world.
Yes, so we're here. We hope to go there one day. Pick another number, please.
5.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5. This is Sleepyhead. Now, this was made into a TV show and is, I believe, the first Tom Thorne novel. From what I hear about this, just a shout line got you a book deal. Can you talk about that?
Well, that's the story I tell. I think it's largely true. Yeah, this is my first novel and this is the book that got me published. And I never thought I could write crime fiction. It was the missing piece of the puzzle for me. I read crime fiction voraciously. I was a writer. I went to all the crime fiction conventions. I hung out. I interviewed writers for magazines and stuff and did reviews. And I thought, but it was the one thing I thought I'd never do. I'd pick up some of these books and they were like house bricks. And I just, you know, how much work is that compared with a half hour of telly or whatever? And then one holiday with the family, I would sit outside this villa on Corfu, put the kids to bed and me and my wife would sit outside and I would just scribble in a notebook sitting there with a cold beer. And by the end of the holidays, I realised I'd written kind of 30,000 words or something. And I did some very basic maths and thought, well, that's about a third of a book, you know, not a finished third of a book or anything. So I went home and I tarted those 30,000 words up and I sent them off to an agent, an old-fashioned, printed-out manuscript.
Those were the days.
But I'd seen all these adverts on the tube, you know, those things, that, and you have that shout line, you know, in space, no one can hear you scream, whatever. And I started to see them being applied to books. So I came up with this shout line for Sleepyhead, which was, he doesn't want you alive, he doesn't want you dead, he wants you somewhere in between. And I put that across the bottom of that manuscript. That's what got me an agent, I'm almost convinced. That's what got me a deal. And a year later, that was on the side of buses.
Fantastic. Let's talk about the, hang on, a year later. A year from, okay.
Well, it was probably, I mean, it was more than a year because I got my book deal on those 30,000 words. I hadn't finished the book. I got my agent sent it out to publishers, a bunch of publishers wanted it. I came in to, you know, see Little Brown, and that's it. I got a deal. I got a two-book deal, and I hadn't finished Sleepyhead, let alone, oh, what's my second book going to be? I hadn't finished the third one. The first one, rather. I hadn't finished the first one.
So that must be a bit of a shock to the system when they sit you down and go, okay, and give you a deadline and say, okay, we're publishing on this date. You need to finish it by this date. Was that, I mean, being a screenwriter, you'd be used to deadlines, but like I say, a novel is a fairly chunky piece of work.
Yeah, it is. But I've delivered a book a year since then, and I've never missed a deadline. I'm quite disciplined, not in the kind of 9-to-5 way, but I have a kind of inbuilt annual calendar. You know, I kind of know, I can go, okay, I can go on holiday and forget about it for a few weeks, or, you know, I can take a month off or whatever it is, but I will always get it finished. But there is a big difference writing a book for yourself and suddenly writing a book because it's your job, you know, and there should be.
No, definitely. Are you a write every day kind of writer?
No, I'm not. I'm really not, because it's not that kind of job. It gets done, but it may be that I haven't written something because I can't write on the hoof. I have to spend a lot of time traveling. I can't write on planes or trains or in hotel rooms. I just can't do it. I have a little notebook that I might scribble a little idea to myself, but I can only write in my office sitting in front of my computer. But that's when you're typing. You know, that's when you're getting it down. You're writing the book all the time. It's in your head all the time.
So do you find you get to a point where there's enough ideas to start writing? And will you sort of say, okay, it's March. From March to April, I knock out a first draft. Is that how you work?
Wow, no. I wish it was March to April. No, I mean, I tend to write a first draft probably in about 10 months. But I have a weird sort of slightly OCD thing. I can't do my first drafts are incredibly clean. You know, if my editor finds a typo in there, I will not, you know, I'm devastated. I mean, I don't just rush to the end and go end of draft one and deliver it. I can't write chapter two until I think chapter one is perfect. I mean, of course it isn't. I've still got to go through an edit and stuff, but that first draft is pretty close. So I will do an edit, one more draft and it's done.
Fantastic. Excellent. Let's talk about the TV, because if you're going to have a TV show, you should really put David Morrissey into it because he is fantastic. How involved were you in that?
I was very involved in it, and it was me that got David Morrissey. It was a fantastic piece of skullduggery. from the moment your first book is published, people say, oh, who would you like to see play, you know, your character? So people were saying, who do you want to see play Tom Thorne? I really had no idea, other than I'd seen David Morrissey in some brilliant things in Blackpool and State of Play. And I just thought, you want a good actor. That's all you want. You want a good actor. And I just thought, if I keep saying his name often enough in interviews, honestly, this is exactly how I thought, then maybe he'll find out about it. So I kept saying, David Morrissey, I'd like this actor, David Morrissey. Cut to several years later, David is filming in, forget where he was, Belgium or somewhere. And he has a couple of days off and he wanders into a bookshop, picks up a bunch of books, one of which is mine, thank heavens. He reads it, he likes it, he Googles my name, and up comes his name. And he goes, wow, I'm playing this guy. He comes back to London, he calls me, I go round to his flat, we get on like a house on fire, done deal.
Fantastic. Brilliant. Pick another number, please.
Nine.
Well, this is Cut Off, which is a quick reads title, which is something that the reading agency does, aimed at people who maybe don't read as much or struggle with reading. You'd think, because they're asking for you know, fewer words and smaller words, you might think that might be easy, but it's not, is it?
No, it's really not. I mean, obviously, you have to bear that stuff in mind. Cut Off is the second thing I did for the quick reads. I did a short story a few years before, but this is much more of a kind of novella. So yeah, you have to bear that in mind, but you story story is king. Story is always king. And you say, you know, it's no different than telling any other story. You've got to hit those beats. You've got to keep those pages turning. It's a thriller. And yeah, you're bearing in mind certain things, as you say, no over complex sentences or massively long words or whatever. But no, it was a very enjoyable process.
Was there anything you learned from that you're going to take forward with your own writing?
Well, there's a great piece of advice. I don't know whether it's one of Stephen King's, if any writers out there need to read On Writing by Stephen King, and there are several things you should just have pinned above your desk. But one of them, I think, is keep it simple, stupid.
Yeah, my number one rule. Pick another one, please.
Four.
Number four. Ah, this is interesting. This is a kid's book, Triskelion, that you wrote under the name Will Peterson with Peter Cox, and there was a trilogy of these. How did this come about?
Peter was somebody I'd written for television with, and I just got approached by a kids publisher who said, you ever thought about writing anything for kids? And my kids are of that age then. It was a mistake in retrospect to not put my own name on it. That was a ridiculous thing to do. I deliberately didn't because I wanted to keep it separate. I wanted to go, these are adult crime thrillers, this is something else. Having said that, I think the body count in those three books was far higher than it has been in any of my novels. It was very dark trilogy books, and I enjoyed writing them, and it was very hard work writing them, but they didn't sell very well. They didn't have my name on. They were an unknown quantity as far as booksellers and stuff are concerned. I'm still very pleased I did it.
Good stuff. They do say writing kids' books is harder than it is writing for adults. Did you find that to be true or just different?
I found it different, but certainly no easier. The idea that you can just knock off a children, I mean, these were full-length novels, you know, a trilogy of them. No, absolutely it was hard work, and so it should be.
I'm going to cheat and pick a number for you.
Okay.
I'm going to go with number one, which is Scaredy Cat, because there's an incredible story behind this in which, and if you're happy to talk about this, you were taken hostage.
Yeah, well, it actually happened before the first book, but it wasn't until the second book that I thought, I'm going to use this. I was taken hostage in a hotel room in Manchester, and three guys in balaclavas burst into my room and tied me up and put a bag over my head and all that. And it wasn't lovely. And then when I sat down to start writing Sleepyhead, I thought, right, I'm going to write about fear and I'm going to write about victims. And that stuff has run through all the books. But in Scaredy Cat, I actually made it a kind of plot line that similar things, actually much worse things, were happening in hotels, and the police were investigating it rather more efficiently than they investigated what happened to me. i.e. nothing.
Okay. But that must have been an absolutely terrifying experience. And you've channeled that fear into your writing. And as you said, there's a focus on victims.
Yeah, focus on victims, because I'd got very fed up of reading books where you have a cop and a killer and they're these two kind of juggernauts on a collision course. And the victim or victims are just plot devices. You know, get to care about them or engage with them. So I wanted to put the victim front and centre in Sleepyhead. And the victim was kind of the main character in Sleepyhead, actually. It was all about her. I needed a cop, obviously, because there was a crime to investigate. So I created this guy, Tom Thorne, little knowing that, you know, I'd still be writing about him 19 books later. But yeah, I wanted to write about victims, and I wanted to write about fear. And Val McDermid, who's a friend of mine and a writer I admire enormously, said that generally speaking, women tend to write about what fear feels like and men tend to write about what it looks like. Violence, especially. And I take it as a great compliment from her that she said, you know, I can write about what violence feels like. And I think you have to have sort of been through it to do that.
Well, let's hope none of our listeners have to go through anything like that. I want to take you back to something you said there, which is you created Tom Thorne without an idea that all these years later, you'd still be writing about this incredible best-selling character. When did you realize you had a serious character?
Well, I mean, the very first question that I got asked by publishers when I walked into their office with a third of a book was, is this a series? I mean, back then it was the Holy Grail. You know, things have changed slightly, but people were very keen on a series, and I'd have said anything to get that deal, you know. but even then, I was thinking, you know, I was a big fan of series fiction. I'd read all the great series right back from Philip Marlowe and, you know, not Sam Spade, obviously, but because he was only in one book, listeners. But, you know, Philip Marlowe and the Ross Macdonald books, and then all the great British writers of series. So, you know, I knew I had, you know, I was going to be dealing with him for a while, but I hadn't got a plan for him. He just sort of turned up in the first book. And I still, to this day, don't have anything written down. Readers know as much about him as I do, you know, which means I get things wrong quite a lot.
So there's no series Bible with, you know, how many teeth he's had out, how many of the, you know, shoe size, anything like that?
Nothing like that, which in one sense is good because it means that he can surprise me and therefore hopefully surprise the reader. He's unpredictable. I don't know what he's going to do next, but it means I get stuff wrong. I'll get emails from readers going, well, have his eyes changed colour? I didn't know that was his mother's name. I thought, you know, I don't have those basic facts written down and I rely on readers to help me out.
But that's how you like it. You wouldn't go back and plan everything out beforehand.
No, And I've made mistakes. If I could go back and rewrite the first book, which oddly I am doing, we'll talk about that in a minute. But I would have made him probably 10 years younger than I made him. I made him the same age as me when I started, and I wish I'd made him younger.
That's what Ben Aronovich said. He said he didn't make that mistake with Peter Grant. He said he see what you guys have done, and like he mentioned Harry Bosch, you know, reaching retirement age just as sales are bigger than ever, you know. So
yeah, no, and the same is true for Ian Rankin and John Rebus. You know, yeah. he wishes he'd made him younger as well.
Okay. Now, you said you're rewriting the first book. Tell us about that.
Well, because 2020 will be the 20th anniversary, and so it'll be 20 years of Thorn in 2020, and we're going to do some things around Sleepyhead. I think we're going to be reissuing the book, and we're doing a big dramatized, fully dramatized audio version of it, which means I've got to go back and record the book. And looking back at it is a rather chastening experience. Not just because you're a different writer, you know, your style has changed, everything has changed in that time. But I made some mistakes, which I'm not going to correct all of them because that would be wrong. But there's a couple of things I did in that first book which I'm going to put right.
This isn't a George Lucas Star Wars thing, no.
No, it's not quite a sort of director's cut, and writers shouldn't have the facility to do that. So there's certain things I've gone, oh, I wish I hadn't done that, but I have to leave it alone. But the one thing I did early on, which I've never done since, and I've always talked about this, oh, you never describe Thorn, what's he like? When I go, well, he's however the reader wants to imagine him, because I don't care what he looks like. But I did put some physical description in that first book, and I'm going to take it out.
Interesting. So you take it away, not necessarily adding. I want to touch on something you spoke about there, which is audio, because quite unusually for authors, you read your own audio, don't you?
I do, and I love it. And that's one of the things, because I started doing it quite late, which means I've got to go back and re-record all the early books, which is I'm doing over the next couple of years. I wasn't meant to. I was asked really early on if I fancied it, and I thought, no, that's a very hard job. I can't do that. So early on, the books were narrated by a brilliant actor called Robert Glenister. And then after the TV show, they wanted David Morrissey to do it. And David said, yeah, fine, and was all signed up to do it, then got a big movie or something, and suddenly couldn't do it, by which time Robert was unavailable. And it was like, don't suppose you fancy doing it. And I've been doing it ever since. And I love doing it, although I'm an idiot. I write the books and I forget that in 6 months I'm going to be sitting in a studio narrating it. So I'll have four Polish characters, three Romanian characters. And I set an entire book in North Wales. And Welsh is an incredibly difficult accent to do. I had to sit in the studio with my wife, who's a Welsh speaker, who every so often would just make that slash across the throat symbol, meaning you've started to sound ridiculous. And, you know, some accents are easier to do than others, but it also serves as my proofread, because it happens, you know, well before the book's come out, we're recording it, so I'm having a really slow read of the book, and I make a few notes, and I can call up and make last minute changes.
That's a very smart move. Our old audio director here, she said she wishes more authors did that, sat down and read it out loud, even if it's just to themselves, because you'll read it and you'll trip over a sentence or something, just think, what was I thinking?
Yeah, absolutely. Reading out loud is massively important. I mean, I tend to do that anyway, especially in dialogue-heavy scenes, because, you know, a line sounds clunky in your mouth. You know it. As you just said, you're tripping over it, and it's not right, so you can change it. At audio stage, it's probably too late to just go, God, that's a really awful sentence. I want to rewrite that. But you can spot, you know, mistakes and errors that have slipped through the net.
Yeah, cool. You mentioned Val McDermid a little while ago. You two are rock and rollers. You're in a band together, the fun-loving crime writers. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, this was a weird thing that happened accidentally just over a year ago. There's a thing called BoucherCon, which is the World Mystery Convention. And it happens in a different city every year. They sort of bid for it, like the Olympics. And a couple of years ago, it was in New Orleans. And on the last night, there was a gig at the House of Blues. You know, how can you resist going along to that? And three of us, myself, Stuart Neville, and Doug Johnston, said, oh, should we get up and do a bit, should we? And then sat at the bar for far too long and forgot the idea. Until suddenly a voice from the stage going, where are the Brits? There are some Brits. And we went, oh, my Lord, we're doing this. So we stumbled up on stage and absolutely blundered our way through three songs. We did Folsom Prison Blues by Johnny Cash. We did Werewolves of London by Warren Zevon. And bizarrely, 500 Miles by The Proclaimers, just oddly. And, you know, in the way of these things, it ended up on YouTube. And then suddenly the director of the Edinburgh Book Festival got in touch and said, right, you're doing an hour and a half in August. And we went, excuse me? Firstly, we only know three songs. Well, we don't really know three songs. And there's only three of us. So we put this band together. I'd sung with Val before. I knew Val could sing. So we got Val in the band. We got Chris Brookmeyer in the band. We got Luca Veste on bass. And suddenly we had a band. And we did that hour and a half in Edinburgh. It was a huge success. We've been touring ever since.
An hour and a half? That's...
Oh, yeah, no, we do. We can play a lot more than that now. Not that we get to rehearse very often. We have to rehearse at soundcheck, really, because we all live, you know, in opposite bits of the country. But God, we love it so much. I'm playing this coming weekend at a festival called Bloody Scotland. We're off to Iceland to gig over there. It's a bunch of middle-aged writers sort of getting their rock and roll kicks. But God knows how any of us are ever going to write a book again, because this is way too much fun.
Yeah, is there a big argument over who gets to be lead guitarist and stuff like that?
Oh no, there is only one lead guitarist, who is Stuart Neville, who is just the most awesome musician. As are Doug Johnson and Luca Veste. The rest of us are kind of clinging on to their coattails and getting away with it. We really don't argue. One of the good things is we don't do original material. That way we would argue. We'd split up within about 5 minutes if we all started writing songs. We just do cover versions of songs about murder and crime, and with all sorts of different inputs. Stuart loves rock. I love country. Val likes folk. Chris likes indie. So we bring lots of different songs to the band, and then we rehearse and we put them in the set. It's great fun.
Brilliant. We'll put a link in the show notes as well. You've got a page on your website, which I think is called Showing Off, which has all this stuff, isn't it? So we'll put a link to that.
Yeah, Showing Off, which is exactly what it is. Anything I've done on TV or stuff with the band or whatever. But, you know, I've always been a performer, and I firmly believe that writing a novel is a performance. I've always thought that. A very different kind of performance, but still you're trying to give the best performance you can give. If you're a genre writer like I am, it's about entertainment. Now, that can mean all sorts of things. You know, there's very dark stuff in there, the odd joke, but either way, you've got to give that performance. So it's just another form of showing off.
That's interesting, because I trod the board myself back in the day. And if you've done any theatre, you're very conscious of the audience and what works and what doesn't. And my first writing was I wrote plays, so I am always thinking of the audience. Is that how you're thinking when you're writing?
100%. It's almost like when I'm writing, there's an invisible reader looking over my shoulder, almost looking at the sentences as they come together. I absolutely write for the audience. I never trust writers who say they don't. You know, those writers who go, oh, I write for myself and I don't give a hoot what the reader thinks. I think, well, good luck, mate. Because the day you stop thinking about that reader, I think, is the day you're likely to become self-indulgent and unreadable. I absolutely do. And stand-up taught me, if stand-up taught me anything, it taught me about engaging that reader quickly. Because, you know, I can't walk on stage at the Comedy Store and go, stick with me, I'll get funny in about 10 minutes. You've got to get funny straight away, and you've got to engage the reader straight away, because that's how I read. I will not stick with a book if I'm not engaged with it. So, you know, you've got to work hard to keep them with you.
That's very good. Listeners, I'm going to put a link to an old Monty Python sketch called Novel Writing Live from Edgbaston, where Thomas Hardy writes Return of the Native with everyone watching. What's next for you, Mark? You've got Their Little Secret coming May next year. Can you tell us anything about that?
Yikes, I can tell you it's not finished. Actually, this is one of the rare occasions where we've nailed the title very early. Sometimes the title is, you know, written in stone from a really early, but recently it's been a struggle coming up with a good title, and back and forth between me and publisher and stuff. But no, Their Little Secret was hit upon quite early, but I'm still got to do second draft of the book. It's done, it's delivered, you know, the hard work's done. Because actually I do think the hard work is in the first draft. A lot of writers talk about how the editing is the hard work, but I've never found that. Yeah, that'll be coming in May. So I suppose I've got a nagging voice in the back of my head going, you've got to write another one quite soon. And that'll be the big one, since the 20th.
Right. Excellent stuff. Well, whatever happens, we know it's going to be a bestseller. People will be queuing up to read it. Mark Billingham, thank you so much for speaking to me today.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, what a cracking chap.
He's brilliant, isn't
he? He's just got that voice of someone that you've met somewhere or know or seen many times.
Yeah.
What a lovely guy.
He's a lovely guy. He's a really lovely guy. Like I say, he's welcomes you into the community, and he's one of these guys who can stand up, talk in front of a massive crowd, or you just have a really nice chat with him for a podcast. Well, I could have him on every week. It's brilliant.
I tell you, he's totally a guy I'd go out and have a pint with down the
no question.
Cornish pub.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
yeah. So lots to talk about, but I loved the fact that this Shoutline got him a book deal. How brilliant is that?
Well, and he took it from the film world. It's interesting because he goes back to a time where books didn't necessarily use that shout line as a marketing tool. It was like, here's the new Jeffrey Archer, go buy your book, you know, kind of thing. Whereas he takes that example from Alien, you know, in space, no one can hear you scream or whatever. You know, those punchy lines that they used in the movies. And so it's worth looking at that language. I know that marketing can make some of us feel a bit squeamish, but just think, how would you sum up your book? I always like to think of it as that if you had just seen a great film and you caught up with your mates in the pub and you're trying to tell them what the film was like, try and think of your book like that. So, you know, it's about this woman who gets a second chance. She goes back in time into a younger version of herself and she gets a second chance to be a rock star.
I'd buy that book.
Yeah, I would.
What's that book called? Does that exist, that book?
I forget. Someone should write that book.
Someone should write, definitely should write that book. Yeah. Maybe two people should write it together.
No.
But shout lines are really important. Shout lines are really important because, and one tip I've got for everyone out there, because I know that Mark didn't really go into how you create a shout line, but I've done loads of them in my life just for many different things, whether it's a project, even a kind of a tag line on a press release, for example. And the way that I do it is you very rarely come up with a shout line straight away. Hmm. I think a lot of people think, oh, I can't think of a shout line. You know, it's too hard. It's actually a process of writing something, anything down. It doesn't matter how bad it is, but just don't have a blank piece of paper. Write down one, and then it kind of starts that process of and you could tweak it slightly, or you can think of something else, and you just start playing them off each other. It's a bit like when we came wanting to come up with band names, and even our book Back to Reality, we had that spreadsheet, didn't we? Where we had like a whole list of how many titles did we come up with?
It was 50 plus.
About 100?
Yeah.
50, oh, yeah, something
maybe,
like that.
Maybe,
and
yeah.
I think shout lines deserve as much attention as a book title, because honestly, the book title often can't tell you what the book is. It's the shout line that basically kind of hooks you in, ultimately. It's like that sing-along chorus line.
Yeah.
So I find that you start with one, and then you probably have to do 20 or 30. It doesn't matter how bad they are, because you only need one really good one to land, and suddenly you've got it. So Mark's made such a good point there. And I think we can borrow so much from the film world as well, because, you know, they don't have much of a chance. You know, it's a one time only. You've got the poster of the movie and they've got one opportunity to catch you in.
Yeah. I mean, if you think back to our episode with Joe Hill, do you remember what he said? He said, why should anyone buy your book? Have you seen what's on Netflix at the moment? You know,
yeah, exactly.
you're not only competing with every author out there, you're competing with home entertainment that we've never known before.
Never
it used to be you'd have to
it,
go
yeah.
out and see a movie. Now I'm watching Haunting of Hill House and seeing the finest horror ghost stories I've ever seen. You know, it's right there. It's just there at click of a button. So you've got to compete for that mind space. You know, someone who's looking to be thrilled by a story, they could have that story as an audiobook, as a Netflix TV show or a movie on demand, or they can read your book. So, you know, you've got to give them the promise of excitement and thrills or comfort or warmth or whatever it is you're selling. And it is tricky. I won't mention their name, but I was having coffee with an author the other day who understandably finds this difficult, that separation between them and the work, because they're like, well, I don't like banging my own drum. People, and a lot of people, especially Brits, we're naturally very, very modest. And I said, you just have to step back and remind yourself you spent at least a year of blood, sweat and tears writing this damn thing. And, you know, you just sell the thing. You don't have to sell yourself. Sell the book. You know, think about the thing that inspired you in the first place, that got you fired up and excited, and put that into the log line. And like I say, you're not going to get it right first time. And test them out on people. Test them out on your friends and family. Say, which of these, you know, would you want to pick up? You know, which of these... And it's a process as well. You know, I gave my middle grade book to Julian Barr, and he came back and he said, oh, it's Son of Rambo meets Guardians of the Galaxy. I was like, I'll have that. Thank you very much.
I'm in.
Yeah, so
that's all you need, isn't it?
Yeah.
The meat one.
Yeah.
Actually, you know what, Mark? You know, you said, you know, in space, no one hears you screaming. That was the example, Mark.
Yeah, yeah.
I've got one for all the writers out there. You ready for this?
Go for it.
I'm going to do my best, my best trailer voice. Ready?
In publishing, no one can hear you not banging your drum.
God.
I think... But it's true, isn't it? No one can hear you not banging your drum.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, if you're in this to get, it's all very well writing a book for yourself, but who does that? Honestly, yeah. Who actually writes a book, sticks it away in 20 years, they get the book out and go, oh, I wrote a book once, I'm going to read it now. No one does that. The reason we are writing books is because we want to share it with the world. It's about the sharing bit that makes us go through all the ridiculousness of trying to be authors and carrying books up and down 3 flights of staircase, right? It's the sharing. And if we don't share it, then no one knows that we exist.
Yeah.
And therefore, we have to bang at our own drum to begin with.
Yeah.
The point is, you're the drummer in the band, and then the orchestra eventually joins in. And then you can just, you're then part of the mix. That's the way of looking at it.
Nice,
you don't
analogy.
Have to bang your drum forever.
Nice.
Do you like that?
I like that.
Quite like that. That could be a motivational minute,
yeah,
right?
Write
there.
That down.
But
write
you know,
down.
It's all right, I'll scribble it down. But it's true though, isn't it, Mark? You've got to start. They always say this, it's always one crazy person that starts dancing. Have you ever seen that TED video? There's a brilliant video in TED, on the TED talk, where a guy in a festival, there's a big lot of people sitting around and some, they hear music playing and there's some hippie sitting down. He gets up and he just starts dancing around like some loony all by himself. And everyone's like, oh, and then somebody eventually joins him.
Yeah.
And then within about 2 minutes, there's about like 1,000 people all up dancing. But it takes that one person to start dancing. And that's who you are as an author.
And
so you just got to pretend you're an actor and pretend you've been given a role of a promoter.
Mm.
And pretend it's not about you. Pretend you just have to do this. You've been given a script and you have to play this role.
I mean,
and
it's understandable. And you hear this with people who are, you know, we say to people, start a newsletter. Again, I was talking to this author the other day and he says, well, what am I going to write about? I've got, you know, he's not Mark Billing. I mean, he can't announce he's just sold 5 million books, which, you know, is a newsletter item maybe. But just, you know, start by saying, you know what, I've just started my new book. Follow me on my journey. I'm going to get, there's going to be ups and downs. And people are, I can tell you, because we did a bloody podcast about it. People will be interested in the challenges you face in writing your book.
Yeah. Can I just give you, okay, this is typically a Patreon level tip. Okay. we only drop the really big gold nuggets for our Patreon supporters, but I'm going to give you a freebie right now, folks. One of the biggest tips you can do if you're trying to build a mailing list and you're trying to build a blog before you even become an author is in your blog, write about A, the challenges that you have as a writer, and B, write about the books that your book will be similar to, because it will draw people to your blog before you've even written it. And then people might sign up to your mailing list. But it's about starting. It doesn't matter where you are. If you keep putting it off all the time, nothing, I guarantee you, nothing will happen. You know, if you don't start pushing that rock up the hill, it's not going to move. So wherever you're at, if you're listening to this right now and you're thinking to yourself, one day I want to write a book, or one, I should be starting a blog, or I should be starting a mailing list, you're basically shooting all over yourself. You need to start doing it.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that? You're watching? What? Shooting.
You're shooting. Yes. Yeah, it's play on words, Mark. So you basically want to get busy and get on with it. Because we all need to practice it. And it doesn't matter if you've got one person coming to your blog. If you've got one person to come into your blog, that's one more than you had yesterday.
Yep.
And it's progress. Like we talk about this podcast. We had one listener when we started out, didn't we? And that was your aunt.
It was. Aunt Marion again.
Aunt Marion. So, God, you know, not even our editor was with us at that time. We didn't have an editor to listen to our podcast. We were editing it ourselves. Everything starts with that first person. And you just need to get on with it.
Yeah.
So, sorry, I'm in a real ranty mood today, aren't
I? It's good. I'm enjoying it.
I want to kick some butt. I did say I was going to kick some butt. They didn't. I warned people. Life's too short, folks.
Yeah.
Get rocking.
Yeah. Yeah.
But when you see Mark's success, though, nice segue back to Mark. When you see Mark's success, though, and you look at, you know, he started off in a completely different industry, really, didn't he?
Well, like me, he wanted to be an actor
now.
You know, I mean, he actually got paid to act, which is more than I ever did. But that got him into TV writing, which led him, you know, to eventually writing fiction. So, you know, it's a journey. You never know where you're going to end up. I love the way he got David Morrissey in his TV show. It's like you and your obsession with Simon Pegg, this sort of cosmic order.
Yes.
So Simon, if you're listening, come on the
show.
Simon,
where are you?
Simon, we'd love to talk
Simon
to you.
Pegg.
Yeah.
Excellent. No, it was great though, wasn't it? Well, he met up with him,
yeah,
and they did. They basically agreed it, yeah, between themselves. I love that. I mean, that's. But the thing is, people think, for example, you know, I could never ask Simon Pegg to come on the show, or I could never ask this actor to be in my show. But that's how it typically happens. You put it out there, put it out to the universe, and
we'll get him.
Cosmic Ordering. That was actually the name of a book. Have you ever seen that book?
Well, Noel Edmonds was into it, wasn't he?
Noel Edmonds was. Yeah, I'm into it as well. I love it. I think it's great. I'm just, it's all about the law of attraction, the power of visualization. God, I could tell you some stuff about that, Mark.
Yeah, I bet you could.
It's brilliant. Also, I one day dreamed that I'd be doing a podcast with another man called Mark, and look what happened. See, it's just...
Also, the other thing I was really interested in, he said when he took his first book in, the first question the publisher asked was, will it be a series? And that's something you need to think about. If you do think it is going to be a series, if you've got a series character, and this is a conversation I had with my agent last week with this middle grade book, he said, is it going to be a series? Because he said children's publishers are looking for series, big IP that they can sell, the film rights or TV rights or whatever. That's what gets them excited. So I've started, and mine will be, hopefully, and I've started jotting down little paragraphs of what book two will be like, what book three will be like, you know, just in the little bits of downtime here and there. It doesn't need to be much, you know, it doesn't need to be Lord of the Rings. It doesn't need to be a 55,000 word outline. It just needs to be a few paras here and there.
Here's a bit of a spanner to throw in the works. If somebody's considering not writing a series around any book, then how good's that first book if they're not that excited about wanting to write a series?
I tell you what. Well, first of all, Back to Reality is a fantastic book. It's a one and done. The End of Magic.
Or is it?
It is. For the sake of our friendship, the End of Magic.
Yeah, but if we had a three-book deal, if a three-book deal suddenly dropped on our lap and someone was offering us $100,000, Cosmic Ordering, would we do it? Question to you, Mr. Stay, would we do it? $100,000 on the table right now. Would you do two more books with me?
Yeah, of course I would.
There you go, you see? Money talks. Money talks.
Oh, I can be bought. Don't you worry. I can be bought very, very cheaply. But The End of Magic, the End of Magic feels like a one and done to me as well. I mean, I've got vague ideas for a sequel, but I just love
how do you follow up The End of Magic, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like... It's the beginning of something else, right? I guess.
Well, if I did a book two...
The End of Magic, it's almost finished, part two.
I've got a title for book two.
Have you?
Yeah. Do you want to hear it?
Yeah, go on. If you do a big reveal.
I would call it The End of Dragons.
Ooh. Oh, I see where you're going. You threw me there. I thought you were going to do something magic, but nice. That's awesome.
Yeah.
You've got, I mean, that, in, but you've got such a powerful series kind of title.
Yeah.
Because the very last monster book. What's going on there? I never even thought. That's incredible.
Good stuff.
That suddenly everything binged. We're both working on different projects and yet they are. So you can't have The End of Monsters, I'm afraid. That's taken.
No, it's fine. There's no monsters. So I got dragons.
Dragons would kick monsters' butts anyway.
Yeah.
Excellent stuff. It shouldn't be allowed. It's too much fun, isn't it?
Yeah.
we shouldn't be allowed to do this podcast. So what else did you... Okay, let's just go back to Mark. Sorry, Mark, if you're listening. He's tuned in to listen to us talk about his important interview, and all we're talking about is Cosmic Ordering and Hobnobs. first drafts. I've got to say, last week, I was really gutted that I was doing my milk tray escapade, because when I heard Alison bang on about her swearing, which I was just like, I couldn't believe it. But then I thought, no, I don't really agree with Alison, to be honest. And I know there's been a lot of discussion about this
on Facebook,
social media. I respect her opinion, but I respectfully disagree. But then this week, Mark says the same bloody thing. What's going on there? We've done how many years of this podcast and we get two authors in a row saying, first drafts are really important. They've got to be as good as they possibly can.
Yeah, well, I think Ben Aronovich is like that as well. I think he delivers what they say is a clean first draft.
That's got nothing to do with, if I were Ben, it's all the second, I'm not doing a bloody second draft. You get paid for the first draft. Give me some more gin.
Have we just blown any chance of getting Ben on the show ever again?
No, because I want to hear Ben do an impression of me.
But yeah.
No, I love Ben, and that's why we can do this.
I think there are authors who can do that. I think Martina Cole's like that. I think Ian Rankin is like that as well. They deliver very clean first drafts.
I bet they started out.
They need very little structural work, I think, because they know what they're doing.
But that's the point, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Their first drafts of their first novels are probably as shocking as everyone else's.
Maybe.
I think the point that Alison was trying to get to last week was, yes, as you write more and more, your first drafts will be better than previous first drafts. But that still shouldn't mean that you shouldn't allow yourself to not beat yourself up if you're not feeling great about it. It shouldn't. I think here's a big thing for me. A bad first draft shouldn't prevent you from actually doing the second draft. Because I think there's a lot of people that have written a first draft and thought it's so bad that they've just thought, I'm never going to be an author. And they stick it away. Yeah. And that's my point. I don't think it's fair that we should not give people permission to write what they think. And again, we are our own worst critics, people. Remember that? You will criticize your own work more than anyone else in the world. So you will naturally think it's not as good as it really is anyway. So I think it's because I want to see people finish their books. I don't want a first draft sitting on a hard disk or a manuscript dusting on a shelf somewhere because somebody believes that they're not good enough. And I think that's more of a travesty than writing a second better draft.
Yeah. I mean, I'd love to get Alison back in the show in about a year's time to talk about her second book and her experience with that as well and how that worked for her.
Yeah, so absolutely.
But yeah, it's...
That would be really interesting. I mean, do people like the new ranty Mr. D?
It's you're feisty and spunky today, sir. Yeah.
If you want more rant, I can give more rants. If you like. Yeah. Let us know.
More cowbell.
Mark, rant. You can start being the optimistic one.
Yeah, I know. It's
all about love, man. It's all about love and peace.
Let's have
dude.
A bit of
calm
positivity,
down.
Dude. What's all yeah, the where is it, vibes, man? Moriarty? Well, look, let's get onto social media, Sam, because we've got a ton to get through.
This is going to be a world record episode, by the way. This one is going to be all records for longest episode ever, so just buckle in, folks.
Well, look, thanks to everyone for getting in touch. We had a wonderful Twitter message from Matthew J. Crocker, who is at Cooks Up a Story. He says, I'm sure you've heard this before, but you all and this podcast are the main reason I pressed on with my writing.
Hey!
We have heard it before and we'll never get bored of it. So thank you.
And we never get tired of hearing that. Thank you.
And Matthew says, the difference that you made for me cannot be measured and neither can my thanks. Having hit a milestone, I'm now encouraged to press on even more. Writing is now an intricate part of my DNA and you will help me make that happen. Thank you. What you do is good. And I think what he's saying there, what you all, that's not just us, that's our guests, that's our community online. You guys are all awesome. We all cheer each other on, particularly now that we're in the middle of, well, coming right to the end of NaNoWriMo. It's been brilliant watching people cheer each other on.
Yeah, absolutely. And we wouldn't have this podcast without you, so you take credit for that as well.
Question. Now, Robin Sarti, who we've had on, I think has been mentioned on every show in the last sort of 6 weeks, particularly while NaNoWriMo, because...
latest sponsor.
Well, Robin, Robin did, she did NaNoWriMo twice, once handwritten, once typed. She did both of those. She did both of those, right? That's as if that's not enough. Then on November the 28th, she said, I've decided to attempt my first 10K day of writing.
Okay, this is getting silly, Robin. Sit down.
Yeah, yeah. And the only way I'm going to...
Get a cold pack on your head.
The only way I'm going to be able to accomplish this is with the help of the writing community. So she starts at 11 a.m., which is a late start, all right?
That's a late start.
If I was doing 10K, I'm starting at 3 a.m. in the morning, you know. I'll put a link in the show notes for the Twitter thread. I'm not going to tell you if she did it or not, but it's Robin, so I'm pretty sure you can figure out whether or not she did.
No spoilers, though.
Yeah, exactly.
That's amazing. This is what we are creating monsters, aren't we? Yeah. I mean, this is great. This is the power of the public declaration, folks.
Yeah, but listen.
Robin declared, she started off with a declaration, didn't she? And now look what's going on.
Yeah, and talking of declaration, I mean, we've got Chelves, who on Instagram is, I might have to spell this out, small chel, S-O-T-L, which is at S-M-A-L-L, small, chel, C-H-E-L-L-E, S-O-T. I'll put a link in the show notes. Anyway, how do you celebrate finishing NaNoWriMo? Well, Chel did it. She said, enjoying this writing ritual, cigar, bourbon, isn't it? But I want to say bourbon because they're chocolate biscuits.
Bourbon.
Yeah. Cigar, bourbon, notebook, laptop. So she won't hit 50,000 for November, but she's hit 20,000 and she's celebrating with a cigar and bourbon. So, you know, that's
special.
I mean, we you know, drink responsibly and we don't condone smoking.
Don't drink over your laptop, especially at the end of NaNoWriMo, because if you spilt that bourbon accidentally on your keyboard and it fried your hard disk, that would be a story.
Yeah. Mark Hood, he did a declaration. His novel, The Fairies Want Me Dead. Do you remember that title? It's fantastic.
Oh, yes. Okay.
He said he's going to complete draft one before Christmas. Well, he did it just the other day, 27th of November. He said, I beat my deadline. He does say, and I shouldn't laugh, but he said being made redundant might have helped a little. So, Mark, sorry about that.
There's a reason that everything happens in life. Yeah, and maybe that's why.
Yeah,
and maybe you needed to get made redundant in order to become a best-selling author.
Yeah, and I said, just saying, you know, congrats and in-your-face redundancy.
Yes.
Yeah, so yeah.
And what a great thing, though. I mean, joking aside, what a great thing to have as a fallback. Not just to keep yourself busy, but to give yourself something to focus on. Because anyone getting married redundant, that is not an easy thing to go through.
No.
So, Mark, we're with you. But also, what a blessing that you've got writing as something for you to get your teeth into and say, right, I'm going to show them and get rocking. I think that's great. So writing saves lives, I think, in many cases. So.
Yeah. Now, it's not only first-time authors who do NaNoWriMo. It's not only us, authors that are maybe got one or two books out there. It's bestsellers like C.L. Taylor, Callie Taylor, who we had on the show back on episode 127. She's a 6 times Sunday Times best-selling author, Callie Taylor. And she did NaNoWriMo. She says, hooray, I did it. Wrote 50,000 words in 27 days. I'd like to say that I could put my feet up now, but I've got 3 days of bookish things in London. She's doing Facebook Live and all sorts of other stuff. So congratulations, Callie. That's amazing that it's not just, you know,
brilliant.
It's even the bestsellers are doing it. Now, I've got a bit of a thread here. This is from Lily M. Writes on Twitter. And this comes after the Alison Belsham episode. She says, I have some thoughts about this first draft thing, and they relate to the public declaration I made to write every day in November. Firstly, it was the right decision not to attempt NaNoWriMo. My November 1st both started and ended on the Caledonian Sleeper. Now, the Caledonian Sleeper is a wonderful train that runs right across the country up to Edinburgh. I think it might even go in even further, but certainly I think Lily's based in Edinburgh, and I've been on the Caledonian Sleeper, and it's wonderful. And she said, it's not got less hectic restructure at work. So again, that's possible redundancy. Job applications, long weekend away. I'm in the middle of planning a flat move too. So that's a lot of real life being dumped on in November there. But she goes on, the commitment to write at least a little bit every day has really worked for me. There have been a couple of days below 50 words and quite a lot between 100 and 200. But there have also been some 1,000-word days, and I've written about 8,000 words since the first of the month. I'm fairly confident what I've written on the good days, the days where I've sat down and written 500 to 800 words of dialogue or adventure. But those tiny days, they almost read like I wrote 100 words at a time, so they will need to rewrite, and that's fine. I still have a base to work from, which I didn't have before, and without having made that commitment, there's no way I'd be making this much progress. Plus, I'm finding that as I'm writing every day, I genuinely am coming up with more ideas, and I'm excited about finishing this novel so I can start working on the next. Thanks for encouraging me to take the declaration and take the plunge. I'm intending to continue the commitment into December and beyond, so please remind me to let you know how it goes. That's at Lily M. Writes. Lily, thank you so much for that. That's
amazing, Lily. And Lily, you have just proven to every single person out there that it does not matter how many words you write a day. That's not the point. The point is writing every day. And if it's 50 words a day, I mean, you've got 8,000 words in a month when you otherwise wouldn't have done anything. Mm. 50 words a day is 50 more words than what most people do. And very quickly, this is so, so important. I just want to mention this, Mark. There is some seriously amazing research out there about habit forming and habit building. Mm. And there's a professor in Stanford who I've worked with, and he talks about getting people to floss their teeth, because flossing teeth is one of those things that we don't do very often.
Got to floss.
And he says, you know what, the best way to get people, even though we know it's hugely beneficial, right? My dentist told me if you had to choose between flossing and brushing, floss, because it's apparently even more beneficial. Yeah, apparently. But I digress. The point is that if you want to get someone to floss their teeth, you challenge them to floss one tooth a night. Just one. That's like Lily's 50 words. And apparently it's those small wins. It's the little things, the 50 word days, that actually form the habit. Not the 10,000 words one day and no words for the rest of the month. It's the 50 words a day. So public declaration time, please, folks. If you are ready to start writing every day, publicly declare to us how many words you're going to write a day. And we want, and I want to see the ridiculously low ones as well. I want to see the 50 words a day ones, because Lily has just proven that that is how you write a book.
Yeah, no question. No question at all.
So well done, Lily.
We've had a declaration from Sam, at Sam J. Write One on Twitter. After a day at the office catching up on the bestseller experiment, my goal is to have my urban fantasies rough draft ready for its first round of edits by December 7th. During this week, I will set up an author page on Facebook, but for tonight, I will sip on some tea and build up my word count. Good luck, Sam. That is in the diary. So,
Great stuff, Sam.
We'll come back to that. And we got a couple of bits of news, some really cool news. Do you remember we had Joanna Nadin, Queen of Bloody Everything? And of course, she wrote the book Joe All Alone, which inspired me to rewrite my middle grade book. Well, it only went and won a BAFTA.
BAFTA?
Yeah, BAFTA.
Amazing. Remember you talked about that it had been
nominated. It won a Children's BAFTA Award, which is just mind-blowing.
Wow.
So huge congrats to Joanna and the production team for that. I think it might still be on iPlayer if you want to check it out, but it's that's fantastic news. So we have, you know, we have award-winning authors left, right and centre. And a last bit of news here, and this is from Rob Gibson, who is at RobGibson34. It was Rob's birthday the other day, 24th of November. Rob says, I bought myself a birthday present. I am now a Patreon supporter of the bestseller experiment.
Oh!
Yeah. He's put here, wait, for your birthday, you're giving someone else money? He says, yes, I'm a maverick. More to the point, it's a great podcast and I'll now get extra goodies. Check it out if you haven't. Rob, thank you so much. Oh, we really, really appreciate that massively.
That is fantastic. Oh, thank you, Rob.
So if you want to be like...
I've never heard that before. That is such a... It's such a beautiful gift for him and such a beautiful gift for us as well.
No, it's just fantastic.
Just all sharing the love.
If you want to be like Rob and get some fun extras, go over to patreon.com/bestseller experiment. I'm working on some really cool stuff that's probably won't be ready until the new year. But I'm very excited about it. We've been talking about this behind the scenes. We're really going to have a big focus on Patreon for next year and providing you guys with some really cool content and getting you involved, making you part of this family. So hang in there. It's going to be wicked.
Absolutely. And if you haven't done so already, pop over to patreon.com/bestseller experiment to subscribe. And you've got three different tiers you can choose from. And we recommend the $10 tier, don't we, Mark, for some reason, because that's the highest one. But no, that's the one where you really get the goodies. The other one's $5 and $2. $2 is if you just want to support the show. And $5
and thank you if you do.
Bonuses.
Yes.
Yeah, cool. And we really appreciate And we do bang on about this because, you know, this is, folks, this is the new model, right? This is the new model. When you put together a podcast, when you do content building, the way that people now are enabling themselves to do it is by getting people to support them ongoing. And it's working brilliantly for so many different kind of businesses. And we're definitely trying to hit our target of, we actually need to get still to about 500 Patreon subscribers. We're only up to, we're nearly at 100. So maybe we could push over 100 this week, but we're getting closer. And we're keeping on plodding on until we get there, aren't we?
Yeah, fantastic. So thank you for that, Rob. Really appreciate that. And thank you to everyone who's got in touch. If you want to drop us a line, it's really easy, really easy. Just you can find us on Facebook. We're Bestseller Experiment. Twitter and Instagram is at BestsellerXP. Or come and find us on our website, bestsellerexperiment.com. There's contact details there. And we love hearing from you. We really do.
Brilliant stuff. And next week, we will be announcing the winner of our De Monza competition. So if you entered that, or if you're a Patreon subscriber, you're already entered. That is a opportunity to win a $500 plus package to get your next best-selling novel cover design. So listen out for that next week, folks. And good luck if you're in the hat to win it.
Does that mean I have to get the drum kit out?
Oh, you'll have to get... We haven't had the drum kit in so long. Oh, that would be great. Yes. I want it extra tinny this time. I want it really, really cheesy, nice. Really tinny.
Good.
Okay,
no problem.
Excellent. Marvellous. In the diary. Brilliant stuff. So thank you so much, everyone, for coming with us on this crazy journey. It is a world record. Just looking at the clock, I think a world record bestseller experiment episode. And we just can't stop talking, really. So we will be here next week. Unfortunately, folks, you can't get rid of us that easily. And we look forward to hopefully inspiring you on your journey, because that is what this podcast is all about. Yep. Helping you on your way to finishing your book. And maybe, who knows, one day coming on this podcast as a best-selling author.
That'd be cool.
Brilliant. So it's a goodbye from Mark 1.
And a goodbye from Mark 2. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye. Love you. Bye.
Love you. Bye.
Love you. Oh, you go first. You go first.
No, you hang up.
No, you hang up.
No, you hang up.
Oh, no,
hang
up. I love you.